Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. This guest is esteemed, seriously.
Absolutely.
On financial crime.
It's another diplomatic spat between Russia and the rest of the world just days before Russia's presidential election kicks off. The president himself, Vladimir Putin, has actually barely campaigned because guess why? Well, victory's all but assured. It's Dan Tanenbaum, PwC Global Sanctions Leader. Dan, you have to look at Russia so much, I imagine perhaps more so over the last week. What are we expecting to happen next? How does this escalate, if at all?
Yeah, and Tom, it was one night in a Moscow hotel, and then I fled the country before daylight the next morning. What came out yesterday with Russia wasn't really a surprise. Most of the people on that list that were designated were already designated under the last administration. They didn't have assets in the U.S., so this may have been more symbolic than anything else. You know, for those of you keeping track, there was a list that came out at the end of January, shortly before midnight, in a congressional mandated deadline, which was really just a list of the wealthiest people in Russia. What people are expecting next is a list of bad oligarchs, those that were tighter to the Putin regime that they may want to put a pinch on.
Excuse me, I'll take it. What's the difference between a good and a bad oligarch?
We're waiting for the administration to clarify that. But essentially,
The Trump administration tries to figure out who's good and who's bad.
I mean, really, and good and bad, I'm making light of. What they're really trying to do, you know, is force a change in behavior of the Putin administration for the Russians to give Crimea back to the Ukraine. To do that, you have to hit closer to the Putin administration, to his cronies.
I want to take this visceral in New York City. I was up on 91st Street yesterday where the Russian consulate happens to be, and the line was out the door of good citizens speaking to their nation, Russian citizens, U.S. citizens, whatever, speaking to their nation about moving back and forth, which is what visas do. Is that where this is heading? Is a real restriction on the movement of average Russians?
No, not at all. And it's still, Americans can still get visas to travel to Russia, albeit single entry visas that are good for about 5 days. That being said, no, this isn't going to be a travel restriction. What this is really going to do is get closer and closer to Putin without being a direct attack on him. But what they need to do is ultimately find assets of his compatriots, so to speak, that are in the U.S. that'll really start to put some pressure on them.
Where's the pressure on their access to capital markets? Because Russia, the timing of this is just beautiful. They come to market today with debt, Tom, and the bids are stacking up. According to our reporting, we've got up to $6.5 billion worth of bids for this debt. There is appetite for Russian debt still, despite all of this political noise.
Well, and not just political noise, but restrictions on the issuance of new debt or equity from certain companies in Russia, which does complicate matters for financial institutions trying to determine whether to take positions or not.
4.75 on 11-year notes might get it done. Granted, there is a yield there for investors. I just think it will be surprising, Tom, for a lot of people that Russia still has this access to capital markets.
Within this is sanctions. What do you expect in the next 1 week at PwC?
I don't really expect anything in the next week. I think what you saw was what came out yesterday. And you know, again, the administration is taking a fairly responsible approach, whether it's Russia or North Korea, with how they've been ratcheting up the sanctions. I don't think they can do anything else before the election.
Eli Lake, who's always incendiary, we love having him on. Eli Lake of Bloomberg View wrote a scathing piece of how the president has to step up, support Ambassador Haley's language. From where you sit, granted distant from politics, in finance, does Mr. Trump have to step in and support Prime Minister May?
He absolutely does. There needs to be a unilateral approach to dealing with Russia. And that's what you saw with the Obama administration and a number of allies around the world with how the sectoral sanctions were rolled out a few years ago. There can't be unilateral dealings with Russia and sanctions at this point. It's dangerous for the message with dealing with them.
We thank you so much for coming in. And we're very fortunate that you're here by 7:30 this morning, because after 7:30 this morning, we can have no one else on surveillance that supports Villanova. We can have no more Pennsylvania schools. Tony Dwyer's not read in on Japanese domestic politics, but he is read in on optimism. Tony, with Canaccord Genuity, Tony, gauge for us the level of your optimism right now.
Well, it's kind of the same as it's been for the last 9 years, Tom. It's pretty high. It's pretty tough to make the case that you're about to have this major decline. We already had it. We had, as you guys know, in mid-January, there was just a ridiculous level of investor optimism coupled with zero fear of Fed coming off the 2017 move. And anytime that's happened in the past, it set the stage for a correction, a temporary correction. And we had it. It was about a 12%, you know, peak to trough correction. That kind of, we're kind of recovering from that. That was, I call it a shock drop. But at the end of the day, the fundamental backdrops are in pretty good shape. You still have a positive yield curve. You still have a strong earnings per share outlook. And the global economy remains pretty sound, albeit with a second derivative slowing.
Tony, you mentioned 9 years, and a lot of people look at that number and they say, well, it's been a long, long time. But when you look over the 9 years, we've had so much disruption in this bull market. We had a Eurozone debt crisis. We had a taper tantrum. We had the jitters about China and the devaluation of the yuan. More recently, we had a vol blow up. It hasn't been smooth sailing at all, has it?
No, it hasn't. It's sort of like, Jonathan, it's a great point because people remember the 90s very differently than I do. I remember 1996 with irrational exuberance, 1997 with the Asian economic crisis, 1998 with a Russian debt default and long-term capital, and 1999 with only a few stocks going up. But when you read about it and think about it, people are like, oh, yeah, it was this great easy bull
easy
market.
Money.
That was the easy money, right? This has not been easy money this time either. It never is. And the problem is price tends to whipsaw portfolio managers and individual investors. In other words, when the market's going up, you feel like it's going to go to a new high in the next 5 minutes. And when it's going down, oh, my God, here's the big correction and it's all over. And ultimately, it's why it's so important for us to maintain and to sit down and say, OK, what is the reason for a positive fundamental thesis?
Yeah.
It always comes down to earnings, and earnings continue to be higher as long as the yield curve is positive.
Tony, what does the gloom crew get wrong? I mean, you know, I get the numbers. You came out with your report. Traffic stopped on Fifth Avenue. I did the math. You're up from that moment. You're up 11% for the year. It's a double digit, Tony Dwyer, and there's a lot of people that don't agree with you. What do they get wrong?
Well, Tom, the title of our you know, monthly picture book is called Evidence Over Emotion for a Reason. I think people get very emotional. They try to think it's different this time. So, for example, it's interesting, and you're a better study of the Fed than I am, but the San Francisco Fed just recently did a paper that looked at the yield curve, figuring out if it's different this time or not. So they've looked at quantitative easing. They've looked at all the factors that people think it's different emotionally this cycle versus any other cycle. And you know what they found? It's not different this time. It's exactly the same as it is. So I think what the bears get wrong, they're never wrong. When the yield curve inverts, it gets crushed. It's going to get crushed as soon as the Fed inverts the yield curve, which they do every cycle. What they get wrong is the timing of it.
Well, Tony, something you've been on top of over the last couple of months and you've really been beating the table about is that what matters here is not the flatness of the curve, it's the inversion, and that equities can continue to rally, continue to melt up through a flattening curve. Is that the big point you're trying to make, Tony?
It is, Jonathan. And again, I really want to be clear on this. People like me, when we say my opinion is, you should ignore us. What I go by is what the evidence suggests. And history is telling us, it's commanding, that the market is going to go higher until it's proven differently, which it hasn't over the last 60 years. Until proven differently, until the yield curve inverts, credit accelerates even toward the end of the cycle. So, again, I think it's so important that we forget about that we're, quote-unquote, 9 years into an economic recovery and look at what is the driver of a change in the economic direction, and it always is the Fed inverting the curve.
So for the banks, and let's pick up on this point, there is a huge consensus buy of the banks in 2018. Are you saying the banks can outperform as well despite the shape of the yield curve?
Well, I think so, and here's our over the course of the last two cycles, which is the only time you can find the real consistent sector makeups that we currently have. So over the last two cycles, the productivity, quote-unquote productivity trade, has worked well as the yield curve flattens from the current degree to the inversion. So what happens is, I call it the productivity trade because if you have inflationary fear, which is what drives the Fed raising interest rates, what's the offset to inflation, especially labor inflation? It's got to be higher productivity for a company. So who finances the productivity? Banks, financials. How do you implement it? Industrials. Who's the technology behind the industrials? Obviously, information technology. So those are the three sectors that most consistently outperform.
On a long-term basis, Tony, does fiscal stimulus, or squared, I guess, give you pause? I mean, the fact is we're going to go into this, and whether we get Trump GDP or something south of that, the equity markets have to deal with fiscal stimulus times two. So what do you do?
Well, I think, again, what you do is you don't change because it's different this time. We've had fiscal stimulus in prior cycles. We've had fiscal.
What's the history of that? What's the history when we get twin deficits?
It doesn't,
twin deficits don't matter.
No, they don't matter until you invert the curve. Think about this, Tom. I get this question so often, as I'm sure you guys do as well. Think about this. If the deficits mattered, how the deficits have gone worse and worse and worse and worse every year. The government debt to GDP worse and worse and worse every year. Where are bond yields and where is the stock market? Bond yields are at a historic low. Stock market's at a historic high. So every time I read somebody like me saying, oh, my God, the debt is going to come home to roost. Yeah, for the last 30 years, it's coming home to roost, and it isn't working.
So, Tony,
down to shutting down credit.
Your advice to retail investors is to just switch off, have one chart on the computer of the yield curve, and just look at it every day, and until it inverts, don't do anything. Keep the buy on equities.
Until past it inverts. Actually, we did a study in our most recent pitch book that found that the peak in the market comes on median 18.5 months following the curve inverting. So what I want to point to is it's not immediate. So first of all, my advice to retail listeners is don't trade off of people like me. Go by what the history suggests, and the history suggests that until the yield curve inverts, you don't need to get worried. No matter what, you know, you're going to have nasty drops, but you want to just stay the course. And also my second thing to individual investors is please, consult with a professional versus listening to guys like me and doing it yourself.
Well, that's good, because that's what John Farrow did with his bracket, Tony. He consulted with a professional.
Is that what happened? I did. I got someone that actually knows basketball.
Hey guys, you know what happens in these brackets, right? It's usually the person that know, like me, that knows nothing about college basketball.
And neither do I.
That ends up winning because we're not trying to game it.
Do you know what someone messaged me about 5 minutes ago?
What?
You and Tom should have your own sports show, the Tom and Jonathan Sports Surveillance Show.
And
I just thought, you wouldn't know what I'm talking about. I wouldn't know what you're talking about. And we'd go for like 60 minutes and no one would get anything out of it.
Michael Barr's headphone had just hit his microphone. Mike, do we need to crowd in on you and Sashnik?
You just described the business of sports.
Can we cover for you if you take some vacation, Michael? Can Tom and I do the show?
Oh, yeah.
Tony Dwyer, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. With Canaccord Genuity, where he is an optimist. He's done the heavy lifting for me and for Professor Irwin at Dartmouth College, which is to talk about the linkage of the fiscal deficit with the trade deficit. They've gone out and asked a bunch of fancy people like Doug Irwin about it. And one of the great things here, Douglas Irwin, is on the fear of the twin deficit and the twin deficit hypothesis. There is this word that I associate with Douglas North at Washington University, ambiguity. Boy, is this a squishy issue, isn't it?
Well, it is, because it's not a one-for-one correlation between the fiscal deficit and the trade deficit, but there is a relationship between them. So we saw in the late 1990s, for example, when we were moving towards a fiscal surplus, we also had a growing trade deficit. So that doesn't really contradict the theory. It's just there are other things going on. So it's, the economist's refuge is always other things being equal. They're not always equal, but other things being equal, a larger fiscal deficit is associated with a larger trade deficit.
The president of the United States doesn't have an ambiguity. He has a certitude that a trade deficit is bad. Let's flip that on its head. Can a trade deficit be good?
Well, it can reflect certainly a strong and growing economy as it has in the U.S. over the past few decades. So when we've done well as an economy, we approach full employment, people have higher incomes and we spend more on imports. And the trade deficit tends to be larger. And we saw during the financial crisis and the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the trade deficit utterly collapsed, fell by half. So yeah. that's not good times. So that's been the experience that we've seen in recent years.
This is really important, folks. I wouldn't normally do this with a guy like Blanche Flower up at Hanover, but I can do this with Doug Irwin. Let's go. Let's go partial differentials right now. American economy good. We buy BMWs, et cetera, et cetera. Imports go up. All of my interviews say we've got to boost exports. Which is the function that Washington can influence? Which is the function that the president can influence with Trumpian policy? Is it better exports or to diminish imports?
Well, once again, these things are outside the control of the White House directly, but economic policy does matter. So the value of the dollar is going to affect our exports and imports, the state of the business cycle and where the economy is, which the Fed has a big impact on. That also affects the state of our exports and imports. And the fiscal deficit, as we've been talking about, too, that has an effect on the relative balance between exports and imports. So the linkages are sort of indirect, but obviously the policy framework matters a lot, and where the economy is matters a lot.
If you're just joining us, Douglas Irwin of Dartmouth College, the classic book, Against the Tide. Can't say enough about it. It's one of the few books, folks, I'd give an aggressive reread to as I read it cover to cover 2 decades ago. In your index of Against the Tide is John R. Hicks. He's the one who took Keynes and said there's this one line, which is a money line, and there's another line, which is the real economy line. Everyone agrees that if we get tax cuts and we get fiscal stimulus, the IS line, the goods line, shifts over and boom, we've got a better economy, at least for the short term. Can you link that, Professor, to dollar weakness?
Usually you think about a fiscal expansion leading to dollar strength because, once again, the economy will be stronger and because there'll be pressure, higher investment demand, possibly larger fiscal deficit, which will raise interest rates and lead to a stronger dollar. So, once again, it's not necessarily always one for one, that correlation, but that's the way you'd usually think about it.
And yet my interviews are, and the reason I brought the question up, folks, knowing I'd get a perfect discussion from Douglas Irwin, a perfect description, rather, is what we're seeing is a weak dollar and the presumption of further weak dollar. How does that cut? Why is this time different?
Well, remember, it's not just what's going on in the U.S., but what's going on in the rest of the world. And I think Europe's come back a bit. Asia's still very strong. So there's other, sources of demand in the world. I think the administration has also been sort of talking down the dollar a little bit. And perhaps the interest rate increases in the U.S. have not been as rapid as many expected. So always difficult to forecast the dollar, but you can try to point to some of the factors that might be behind it.
Do we get a free lunch because of seniorage? Do we get a free lunch because we're the dominant currency?
We do, and I know you've had Barry Eichengreen on your program, too, and he's always invoked the French premier who said that there's an exorbitant privilege. The U.S. has an exorbitant privilege when it comes to the dollar. We really don't have to worry about the financing of our external imbalances. It sort of happens automatically. And, there's a downside. There's an exorbitant burden some people have pointed to, is that the dollar is structurally overvalued in the sense that there's this huge demand for this safe currency asset.
One of the tricks.
And so that's something the Trump administration has to think about as well. Do they want to undermine that take the dollar away from being the world's reserve currency?
I want to, in the final moments here, folks, with Doug Irwin again, folks, I'll put this out on Twitter. I can't convey enough a careful reread of Against the Tide. And I should point out that Professor Irwin has many other efforts out more current. In your index, and folks, you can tell about an author in the index about where he's focused. You are focused on Jacob Viner, V-I-N-E-R. Doug Irwin, years ago, you gave a lot of square footage to the professor from Chicago. Who was Jacob Viner?
Jacob Viner was a professor at the University of Chicago for many years, and then he ended his career at Princeton University. He was one of the great international economists of the 20th century and made great contributions not just to how we think about trade theory and international economics, but you know, he talked about customs unions and trade diversion and trade creation and created a lot of concepts that were still in use today.
And he was definitive on mercantilism and our myths of it. We all have in our minds this word we learned and forgot, the bad things of evil mercantilism. When you hear President Trump's rhetoric, does it get you back to that classic Viner paper of 1948 in the idea that we're becoming mercantilist America?
Well, it does, in particular when you hear the president say that trade wars are good and are easily won. You know, that's where the lessons of the past just haven't sunk in some sense. Because we've been down this road before, we've seen this script before, and it usually doesn't end up well for anyone. And I think the European Union Commissioner said it well, is that we can do stupid too if you know, we think raising trade barriers is going to be the
way
to
do it. Well, that's the heart of the matter here, is the game theory, and I've mentioned twice this week already, you talk about Viner and Princeton folks, Avinash Dixit, the art of strategy, the art of game theory. I mean, this White House, or let me rephrase that, Ross Navarro is basically game theory free, right?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to figure out exactly what if there's something deeper than what they say. You know, once again, they haven't revealed it, so maybe there's some big design here. But it seems like it's sort of incremental measures without a big strategy and a big think. I mean, once again, it was very impulsive to pull out of TPP without thinking through the geopolitical and strategic consequences.
Yes, but to be fair to the President of the United States, both candidates wanted out of TPP because that's the only way they could get elected.
But he also said that he wanted to renegotiate something bilateral with all these partners. And the problem is he's offended so many of our trade partners that they don't want to undertake bilateral negotiations. So you've sort of given up something big and not gotten anything to replace it.
This has been wonderful. Douglas Irwin, I know you've been on the road traveling. Greatly appreciate your time this morning. Douglas Irwin is at Dartmouth College holding court there with someone else you know, folks, from the show, David Blanchflower, among others as well. The book is Against the Tide, An Intellectual History of Free Trade. There's no mathematics in it, but I'm going to tell you folks, you don't breeze through it. It's not a page turner. It is the definitive book on how we got here in the intellectual struggle over this strange concept that everybody's for, but everybody has trouble explaining it as well. I can't say enough about truly the classic, and it was instantly a classic, Against the Tide, Douglas Irwin. Face the Nation, of course, on CBS. You'll see it Sunday morning. I know CBSN will have it a little bit after Face the Nation at 9 a.m. And, of course, we will have Face the Nation for you 2 p.m. on Bloomberg Radio as well. And joining us now, Margaret Brennan, who is the host of Face the Nation. Thrilled to have her with us this morning. Margaret, you've been on the watch at CBS with State for a number of years, including your travels with John Kerry. How critical is it that we have a Secretary of State designate? And am I right, Margaret, that the Pompeo exercise could go well into August?
Well, you know, that was one of the questions, Tom, that I put to Senator Bob Corker, who was going to be one of my guests on Sunday, because he has to oversee these hearings, confirmation hearings for Mike Pompeo. He won't be pinned down on exactly when Mike Pompeo will be in that post. April, mid-April is sort of the earliest we're hearing he could even begin those hearings. And there is a real need to have a confirmed Secretary of State in that spot because there are a number of things happening in May. That Iran nuclear deal decisions, stay or go, North Korea talks, a number of big pressing issues. And right now you have the president looking at shaking up further his national security team. So there's real concern.
We have people we talked to, Richard Haass, Counsel on Foreign Relations, Nick Brady, of course, with his service to Republican administrations, who are looking into the State Department, but they really don't know. You've been following State through the emptying of that famed building. How empty will be Secretary Pompeo's State Department?
Well, there's a hope that because Mike Pompeo has a good personal relationship with the president, that he can kind of unstick some of those bottlenecks that have been there with, you know, Rex Tillerson had all these choices for people he wanted to put into spots and they couldn't get White House approval. But then there's also the problems of, you know, Congress is backlogged or has been some obstruction, you know, objecting to some of the president's nominees. All the worker bees at that mid-level that follow and carry out the president's policy, there are real problems with vacancies at the State Department. That's also why when you have seen these exits from high-profile people like our North Korea envoy who quit last month, it is a real concern because you basically have the generals on the foreign policy front exiting, and you don't have that middle management. So the hope is Mike Pompeo can get someone in there, but it's not clear what he's going to be like as a policymaker. He's been on that analyst side as CIA director.
You bring up the generals. Break some news with Bloomberg Radio, Margaret, instead of CBS this morning. With her General McMaster, you've got the inside story. My head's spinning after the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the press secretary comes out. What is actually the reality at 9:05 a.m.?
Well, look, the president's been advised, if you're going to further shake up your national security team, get it all done in 1 week. Use Rex Tillerson's ouster as a chance to sort of hit reset. So if you want to shake it up, do it by Friday. The president doesn't always follow the advice he's given. It's not clear that he's going to act on that. But I have to say, H.R. McMaster has taken a lot of heat since he took this job. I mean, he is perpetually rumored to be departing. It sounds like this is reaching a fevered pitch at this point. He's been on the opposite end of arguments with Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis, who were kind of a united front. Does that mean he's strengthened now because of Rex Tillerson's departure, or does that mean he's in peril? It sounds like the exit ramp is there. They're looking at jobs for him possibly on the Korean Peninsula to take a fourth star, maybe go into a command role there, but it's not clear when that may happen.
Let me bring in my colleague, Pim Fox.
Margaret, just wondering in the context of your conversation with Senator Corker, whether the appointment, of course, of Mike Pompeo to lead the State Department, whether that will open up the conversation about Iran and nuclear weapons, particularly in light of Saudi Arabia saying that they would develop nuclear weapons if Iran does the same.
Oh, this is a decision that's going to have huge implications, not just for the oil markets, but just for, like, U.S. policy and the world. May 12th, that's the day to put on your calendar when the president has to make a decision on whether to continue to waive sanctions on Iran. Mike Pompeo is a huge skeptic of the Iran deal when he was in Congress. Does his perspective change when he becomes Secretary of State? We don't know yet, but it looks like, according to Bob Corker, this president is going to pull us out of that international accord, and that is going to have huge ramifications. You have a number of flashpoints in May, potentially with Iran. That's just one of them. And it is a huge question mark. If you get out of an international agreement to freeze Iran's nuclear program, which isn't anywhere near as developed as North Korea's existing weapons program, what is that boat? Does Kim Jong-un just say my deal stands alone, or does he say, wait, you know, this accord was broken, why should I agree to give you anything? It's a question Bob Corker and other skeptics have raised here, saying, look, we may not love the Iran deal, but don't just throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Let's improve it.
You mentioned North Korea, and I'm wondering whether that is a topic for Senator Corker as well. North Korea sharing their nuclear knowledge with Iran, and whether any kind of rapprochement between the United States and North Korea will have an effect on that.
Well, we have South Korea's chief diplomat. Their foreign minister is going to be on the show with me on Sunday. She flew here to meet with Rex Tillerson and then said, oh, wait. Do I still come to Washington? She's still going to the State Department to have some of those meetings and talk about why there's been absolute silence. Kim Jong-un hasn't said whether he does plan to meet with the president or not, remember? He kind of didn't reply to the president's public acceptance. So we want to see what's happening with that on the diplomatic front.
Who else do you have on the show this Sunday, Margaret Brennan?
We also have an independent voice. Senator Angus King of Maine will be joining us. And Rand Paul of Kentucky, who has already said he's opposed to the nominee to be the new Secretary of State and the nominee to be the CIA director.
Margaret, I don't care. Can Virginia get by Kentucky?
Wahoo wah. Don't bet against Virginia.
Margaret Brennan, thank you so much. With Face the Nation, of course, out of UVA as well. Of course, you can see Face the Nation on CBS and CBSN. They do that at 9 a.m. Sunday morning. Hear it on Bloomberg Radio, 2 p.m. We'll have that for you Sunday afternoon as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.